National Gallery Podcast.
This is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. First, a visit to Making Colour, the gallery's exhibition exploring the dazzling array of pigments artists have used over the centuries. Leah Caribbean met up with Oshok Roy, the National Gallery's Director of Collections and co-curator of the show, to find out more about the history of one particular part of the colour spectrum, yellow and orange. They took a look at a 17th century depiction of Saint Cecilia by Pietro da Cortona, where the patron saint of music wears a luminous orange gown and a vivid blue mantle lined with yellow. As Oshok Roy explained, these colours are a curious mixture of old and new.
The clear blue colour is lapis lazuli ultramarine, just like the early pictures that we have in the show. But the yellows are a really new introduction to painting, and they only came into use fully in the 17th century. They were actually coloured materials that were developed by ceramicists to use to decorate the kind of ceramics that are called majolica ware. And that technology of colouring ceramics was transferred to the painter's palette, and that's what we're seeing here.
That's wonderful. You've got some very beautiful examples of majolica ware in the exhibition, including a beautiful plate with a decorated deep orange and blue rim. When artists saw these, they must have gone, wow, I've got to get some of this colour into my painting. Is that how it happened? Is that how the transfer of colours took place?
I think that's a very interesting model of how it might have taken place, but we don't really know what happened. But the manufacture of ceramics in the 16th century was quite widespread in Italy, and there were painters who were decorating ceramics who were really quite good painters in their own right. So one imagines a community of artists who were working on ceramics may have known painters of easel pictures, and that kind of connection probably brought the materials together between these two creative industries.
And so what happens to orange, this wonderful colour that we have in St. Cecilia? We know is a mixture, isn't it, of yellow and red. But does orange turn up as its own pigment at any point?
They're not all that many pure orange pigments available to early painters, but there is a very interesting mineral, quite rare, called realgar. And we have in the exhibition a painting by a Dutch flower painter called Rachel Rausch. And she has used realgar as a pigment to depict the large lily, orangey lily, at the centre of the picture. One interesting thing about this material is that it's exceedingly poisonous. And so painters had to, you know, beware in their use of it. There's a sort of a health and safety issue there.
So when it comes to the story of orange and yellow, it's sort of the arts of fire on one hand and poison on the other. I suppose, you know, artists are actually, maybe we should re-evaluate them as intrepid pioneers.
Well, one thing I think Making Colour tells us is that this has been a long struggle for painters to find the right sort of materials to use in their pictures. And they went to all kinds of different lengths and trouble to ensure that their paintings would survive over the ages. And they were very interested in the stability of the colours. And so this was always an issue for all painters at all times.
With thanks to Oshok Roy. As the Making Colour exhibition reveals, artists traditionally created colour by mixing raw ingredients into paint by hand. The process fell out of fashion with the advent of industrially manufactured paints in convenient tubes in the 19th century, but it's still possible to buy ground and powdered pigment if you know where to look. Just a short walk from the National Gallery, the artist's suppliers, Cornelissons and Sons, stocks jar after jar of different colours. Janko Tichov, artist and former manager of the shop, showed Cathy Fitzgerald a few of his favourites. He began with Indian yellow, now so rare it's a museum piece and not for sale, a good thing given the nature of its production, which was said to involve distilling the urine of cows fed on a diet of mango leaves. Cornelissons owns a large glass jar of this historic pigment. At first sight, it's underwhelming, dark, mustardy chunks of colour, but as Cathy discovered, it's not as innocuous as it looks.
The colour becomes apparent once you start grinding, so it's not what you see as a lumpy form. It gets much kind of brighter, earthier. And
a much brighter, earthier yellow.
Yeah, you could actually see little bits of the brightness of it, kind of more inside.
Can I have a smell?
Yes.
I've heard tell that it's rather rather potent.
Mm.
sure how would you describe that smell? It's sort of it's a strange combination of very dank cave with very acrid urine-y smell.
It is. It is a smell of kind of life, if you like. Yeah, it's quite incredible.
I think that's a nice way of putting it. Yeah. Okay, so we've got genuine. That's genuine Indian yellow, very rare, can't be bought. And just up on the shelves, we've got all of these other pigments that people can buy, things like the rose madder. And yes. I rather love the names.
Well, you picked the early colours, you see. Those colours have not changed, even in terms of names. And rose madder is, again, one of them. It's derived from madder root, and it's so beautiful.
From madder root, yes. Yeah. It's just this very, very pale, silky pink.
Indeed, yeah. And we do have the madder root somewhere, and you would never recognise that you could get that kind of tint from it if you see it in roots form. So again, this is going back to the Indian yellow, that you see the real power once the pigment has been grained, not in a lumpy or...
When it's ground.
Yeah, ground, sorry. But we do have other interesting things, like some organic pigments, such as the genuine carmine, which I could show you.
Yes, please.
Genuine carmine initially derives from cochineal, so it's the actual
the
beetles,
insects. Yeah. Ah, so a very, very tiny jar of deep, deep red. Yes. I want a dress of that colour.
Yeah, well, this is it. I think once you see the pure form, there is nothing like it. It's just, amazing.
And what I love is the idea that if you're using pigments, you're getting a sort of waft of the Renaissance. You're smelling what the artists would have smelled. They would have recognised the process of mixing. They might have had their minds blown by the range of colours and by the relative cheapness, but there is a similarity in process.
Yes, absolutely. I think there are great advantages of using pigments, actually, versus, for instance, ready-made tubes. First of all, you know exactly what's in your colour as you make it yourself, and it's a bit like cooking. You know exactly what your recipe is. And then you're not that surprised by the performance because you know what you've made. But yes, it's a beautiful thing to do, to make colour. I would definitely recommend artists who have not done it because of the convenience of picking up a tube from the shelf to actually try and do it. I think once you do it, there is nothing quite like it, and you may end up kind of enriching your approach to painting generally.
Thanks to Janko Tichov and all at Cornelissen and Sons. The Making Colour exhibition runs through to the 7th of September. Tickets are available at the gallery or online with a booking fee at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. Venetian-born Rosalba Carriera was one of few women to make a successful career as an artist in the 18th century. She began by painting tiny pictures on ivory to decorate the inside of snuff boxes, and by the time she was in her 20s had attracted international clientele for her pastel portraits. The National Gallery's collection includes a shimmering pastel of an unknown gentleman that, after many decades in storage and quieter rooms, has recently moved to a prominent position in the main galleries. Letizia Treves, curator of Italian and Spanish paintings 1600 to 1800 and head of the curatorial department, introduced Cathy Fitzgerald to Carriera's Portrait of a Man. Made in the 1720s, the work depicts a handsome young man in profile, wearing a powdery white wig and silver-grey coat with embroidered brocade. Letizia began by pointing out the subtlety of its colour scheme.
It's a wonderfully luminous object. It's this wonderful, almost monochromatic kind of harmony of greys and whites and the softness of the pastel, particularly this sort of blended quality of both the velvet coat and the powdered wig, which contrasts with the detail of the lace trim. She's certainly one of the leading exponents in this medium.
What makes her so good?
I think she understood the pastel medium so well. You know, the beauty of pastel is it's a combination of colour and line, and so you can create detail, a glint of an eye, a gleam on a button, but you can also create this wonderfully powdery feel, and I think it's something she really exploited using pastel in its dry form. Later on, artists like Degas or Dion Redon added water and then adapted the medium and experimented with it. But she used it in a dry manner, and of course that's very much suited to portraits. Particularly grand tour portraits, you have fewer sittings, very little time. It's not like oil paint, you don't have to wait for it to dry in between sittings. So it really suited the type of work she ended up doing, really.
And he's actually been tucked away downstairs in the lower galleries until quite recently, hasn't he? So this is the first time in a long while that he's back up in the main rooms.
That's right. He hasn't been on the main floor for about 50 years, which is amazing. I mean, it's such a high-quality object. And earlier this year, we changed the fabric in this room, in room 39, and I took that opportunity to rehang the room. And I decided it would be a good idea to bring him upstairs and put him alongside some view paintings and Longhi's genre paintings and really show the variety of what was being produced in Venice at this time. The pastel itself is very fragile, so that's probably why it hasn't been on the main floor. It's very sensitive to light, and that makes it very difficult to hang in the main galleries where you have a lot of natural light. But I took the decision earlier this year to close the skylights here, like we do in room 46, with where the Degas pastels are. And I was very keen also to unify this room. This room's always been rather a challenge for the curator of this area, because half of it's Spanish with Goya and half of it's Venetian. And I think Rosalba's pastel is this wonderful grey hue, and it ties in with the portrait of Peral by Goya on the other side.
Oh, yeah, which is also sort of very silvery grey tones.
Exactly, exactly.
So it's a cunning way of bringing together Venice and Spain.
Indeed, trying to link two schools which are not easily linked in another way.
Letizia Treves. And if you'd like to see Rosalba Carriera's Portrait of a Man and Letizia's cunning rehang, pay a visit to room 39. That's it for this episode. If you're visiting, don't forget we're open 10 till 6 daily and till 9 on Fridays. Until next time, goodbye.